We have, and again, with a very, very special welcome, Joanne, to your in-laws. It's a treat for us to have you together with us, is to discuss something which is, I guess, very appropriate for this time of year, and very appropriate in two senses. Obviously, we're now bridging between Yom HaShoah, which is coming already this week, and next week with Yom HaAtzma'ut. And so my words are certainly with that in mind. And then on the other hand, as we spoke about just a little bit before we broke for Pesach, this Chol HaMoed marked the 25th Yortzeit of Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik of the Rav. And I thought it would be appropriate to share some of his Torah as it relates specifically to this time of year. As I think most people here know, Rabbi Soloveitchik did not spend very much time at all in the land of Israel. He took one trip there when he was running to be the chief Ashkenazic rabbi of Tel Aviv Yafo, a position that he did not ultimately receive in 1935, but for somebody who lived from 1903 to 1993, he surely had many more opportunities to go, and you know, for whatever reason, that was not something that he chose to do, even though he had first-degree relatives there, and a daughter there, and grandchildren there, etc. This was not something that he chose to do. But that is not synonymous with the idea that somehow Israel or Medinat Yisrael was ever very far from his mind. I spoke a little bit about, before Pesach, how it's important to remember historical context. The Rav came from a family that not only was not Zionistic, or what you might call a-Zionistic, in other words, not for or against, just kind of neutral or apathetic, but the roots of the family were very much anti-Zionist, against political Zionism, for a variety of reasons, but sort of in broad strokes, the idea was that this was not a movement that identified, as far as the Rav's ancestors were concerned, with Torah as their modus operandi. They weren't trying to operate based on Torah principles, or even in a less practical sense, that didn't perceive what they were doing necessarily in terms, historical, religious terms of returning the Jewish people to their ancestral homeland as part of the vision that we have, that we express every single day, in the Amidah of Tekah b'Shofar Gadol l'Cheruteinu v'Sanes l'Kabetz Galuyoteinu, that this is part of a historical movement of Shivat Zion, and so really a movement that they could not identify with. In the wake of the Holocaust, however, apropos Yom HaShoah, the Rav's approach to this topic, this is one of, I would say, two major breaks that he had with the approach that he was raised with, the other being approach to general studies, or what some might refer to as secular studies. So here the Rav very much broke with the family tradition, and in light of the destruction that European Jewry underwent, and as is referenced in the essay that I want to discuss today called Odido Fake, the Rav came to the conclusion that the Medinat Yisrael not only was legitimate, but was absolutely deserving of our support. And not only that, but he saw it as an expression of divine providence. And we just read Shir HaShirim this past Shabbat on Achron Shel Chag, so just literally 48 hours or so ago. And he borrowed the expression in the fifth chapter of Shir HaShirim. The great metaphor of Shir HaShirim is that you have two lovers, and they constantly are longing for one another, and then somehow missing each other, as the case may be. And the apex of this motif throughout this poem is in the fifth chapter, when the beloved is in her tent, and she's sort of gotten ready to go to sleep for the night, and he comes knocking on the door, and she says she hears him. She knows he's outside. Kol Dodi Dofek. She responds, the Rav turned, with some kind of inertia, insanity even. She says, Pashatati et kutanti echachal bashana. I've already, changed my clothes. How can I get dressed? Rachatsti et raglai echachai tanfeim. I've showered already. Can't possibly get up and get out of bed, which makes sense if, it was a work meeting, but if this is, the beloved of your life, it's a little strange. So he took this to be a profound metaphor for when God is knocking at the door, we have to respond. And he related to the creation of Medinat Yisrael, the sovereign state of Israel, and this essay was written in 1956, as an expression, as we'll see, a sixfold expression of a divine knock at the door. And the Rav implores American Jewry in this essay to become involved in the project of building Medinat Yisrael. But not just the project of building Medinat Yisrael in a general sense. What I want to come back to at the end of my remarks today is he had something very specific in mind. And he was, even in this, 1956, the State of Israel is only 8 years old, he was more critical than I have ever personally heard or in writing read any other rabbi be of the American Jewish community's approach to the State of Israel. And so I want to actually read from this passage because I think that even though it may be a little bit difficult to swallow, it's important, it's very important to hear and to allow the message to continue to resonate in the authentic way that it was delivered. First, what were the six knocks? So the first knock, and this is probably the part that became most famous about this essay, is the Rav notes that there was a knock in the political sphere. Everybody here is familiar with November 1947, a plan to partition what was then mandatory Palestine into what would be a homeland for the Jewish people, to make good on the Balfour Declaration of 1917, but so as to avoid enraging the indigenous Arab population, to give them a very substantial portion of the parcel of land between the Mediterranean Sea and the River Jordan. So this was voted on in the United Nations, and of course a certain majority was needed, and that majority was arrived at. But what was so bizarre from a geopolitical standpoint about this vote is that, the context of the vote being November 1947, so this is very much during the Cold War. The United States and the Soviet Union have already began their nuclear arms race. This is the time surrounding what would become the Berlin Airlift. People are familiar with the history. And so almost by definition, what the United States is in favor of, the Soviet Union opposes. What the Soviet Union is in favor of, the United States opposes. And in this one instance, God arranges it, the Rav says, so that the Americans and the Soviets are somehow on the same side. Now, it wasn't just about those two votes, which was important enough, but you have to remember that in the geopolitical structure of the world as it existed during the Cold War, it was America and its sphere of influence, and the Soviet Union and its sphere of influence. So that means so that if you have America voting one way and the Soviets voting one way, that carried with it many other votes. Had the Soviets opposed it, then they would have been able to carry many states with them. So the Rav wrote very famously, he says, now you may think that the person who opened that session of the General Assembly was a human being, but he quoted from the Gemara in Masachas Megillah, from the beginning of the sixth chapter of Megillat Esther, the Pasuk says, Balaila hahu nadidash nad hamelech. On that night, the king was unable to sleep. And the Gemara famously comments, it wasn't really Achashverosh that couldn't sleep. If it was Achashverosh that couldn't sleep alone, big deal. But as the Gemara says, Nadada Shnat Malko Shel Olam, that the king that we're referring to here is, of course, Hine Lo Yanum Velo Yishan Shomer Yisrael, that the God of Israel would not sleep or not slumber. In other words, that he had set a process in motion. So that was knock number one. The Rav said, I don't understand how anybody could observe that geopolitical event of the United States and the Soviet Union. Again, here we are in Chadash Tachar HaShamesh, right? Reliving all of that tension right now. How they could be on the same side, it's just unbelievable. knock number one in the political sphere. Of course, in the military sphere as well. The moments after the State of Israel is declared, May 1948, so Arab armies invade Israel in great quantities. Israel is completely surrounded. You'll recall that at the time it was an arms embargo. It wasn't like, you know, today Israel gets F-35s from the United States of America. We collaborate on Iron Dome. There's $4 billion in military aid. There was an arms embargo. The Jewish state had nothing to fight with. They got a few things that were smuggled out of the United States. I'm proud to say that my great-grandmother was a smuggler. I think the statute of limitations has expired on that, as I'm sure many people here were connected to that story as well. And those who saw Above and Beyond, the story of the origin of the Israeli Air Force, know all about smuggling planes out of the United States and through various ports all over the world. So, you know, the Israeli Air Force, which again today is feared as amongst the most powerful in the world, you know, constituted by seven single engine propeller planes at that period in time. So the Rav said the second great knock was, as we say in the Al Hanisim prayer that we add on Hanukkah, Rabim Biyad Me'atim. This idea of masses and masses of trained Arab armies, the Jordanian Legion, which was considered one of the elite armies in the world, trained by the British Army, that they were held off by people that had, you know, virtually no military training whatsoever. And again, in very small numbers, this was itself a second great knock. The Rav was, as everybody here is aware, versed in all of Chachmas HaOlam, in all of philosophy and literature of the world, and he was deeply familiar with Christian and in particular Catholic theology. And so the third knock, which from the Rav's point of view, he says maybe the most significant, was what he called a knock in the theological realm. So again, the first one is political, the second one is military, and the third is theological. For the better part of two millennia, the Christian Church said that we can't take the Old Testament all that seriously, right? The Old Testament, where it says that God has chosen the Jewish people and that the Jewish people will be returned to their ancient homeland. Of course, these things aren't happening. It's all a metaphor, and it must be that at some point, what happened was, as happens throughout Sefer Bereishit, the theme of Sefer Bereishit is the older child is always sort of displaced by the younger child, right? So Yishmael is kicked out, and Yitzchak stays in the house, and Esav is kind of pushed off to the side, and Yaakov gets the bracha, and maybe Reuven also, and Yosef gets to be the bechor, and so that was the theology of the church. The theology of the church is that Israel is displaced, and its younger brother, the Christian church, is called Veritas Israel. That's the Latin expression. It means the true Israel, the true chosen nation. And the Rav said the creation of the State of Israel means that Christian theologians can no longer make this claim. They can no longer go around saying that the God of Israel has abandoned the Jewish people and chosen the church in its place. And he would talk about the visceral satisfaction that he would get. He would go out of his way to read the Christian press and to have them refer to the State of Israel. And how important this was at the theological plane. This is what we call a Kiddush Hashem, and it's reminiscent of the Navi Yechezkel, who talks about that when the Jewish people will be brought back to the land of Israel, Lo lema'anchem ani oseh ki'im lishmi hagadol. That I'm not necessarily doing this because you deserve it, but because my name is exalted and elevated, that everybody sees that the God of Israel was truthful, as the Navi Shmuel said, Netzach Yisrael lo yishaker, that God does not prevaricate, God does not tell stories, God is truthful to the very last letter of the word. God's promises were absolutely meant to be kept. So that was knock number three. Again, and then a knocking in the theological realm. Knock number four, the Rav relates to the mass assimilation that he saw amongst American Jewry. The Rav came to this country again December 1932, and he's writing this essay in 1956, but reflecting on the years of the 30s and 40s. The years of the 30s and 40s, so Orthodoxy in America was in a state of a complete and utter degradation. There's a massive, massive exodus from tradition, This was coupled with people in general leaving urban areas and moving out to the suburbs. Orthodoxy had no presence whatsoever in the suburbs. And now, of course, today we laugh at that, but that was the reality. And the idea of holding young American Jews who had, their own American dreams within the fold was something that was a near impossible task, swimming against the current, to say the very least. That this is really where the day school movement is in its infancy. The Rav starts the Maimonides schools. There are very few places where Jewish children are being afforded the day school education. You have a Talmud Torah under the best of circumstances, and that system had all different kinds of problems. And the idea that there is a powerful, or even a Jewish state, before it becomes a powerful Jewish state, before 1967, but the idea that there's a Jewish state and a Jewish person could be proud to be Jewish. A Jewish person could be proud of a state that's fighting for its survival, right? So many Jews, especially if you saw that movie Above and Beyond, and you're dealing with non-Orthodox American Jews who were talking about their associations with Judaism growing up in the late 20s and 30s and early 40s before they joined the American Air Force in the Second World War. Their association was to be a victim of anti-Semitism. So if your selling point to a young, it's hard enough today, right? But if your selling point to a young person is, guess what? You get to be part of a people that people don't like. Yeah, you get to be made fun of, right? It's not a very compelling sell, right? And the idea that there was all of a sudden the Medinat Yisrael and the sense of pride that brought to Jews who were far removed from, at that point, from traditional observance, the Rav considers a fourth knock at the door. It's an opportunity that we have to take advantage of. Number five, the Rav returns to the military realm. And the Rav here notes that the idea that Jewish blood can be shed with impunity, which Jews unfortunately had to live with for the vast majority of our existence in the diaspora for millennia. What were the Jews going to do? The Jews were going to stage a counter pogrom in Kishinev. The Jews were going to stage there's going to be a counter pogrom in Kiev. On Kristallnacht. The Jews are going to stage a counter boycott, and this is not today where we can go down to NORPEC on April 25th and start a counter BDS and have all kinds of, we're living in a different world, right? The Jews were, there's a member of my shul who was raised in Cologne, Germany. He's 11 years old on Kristallnacht, born 1927, and he watched his shul burn down. The fire trucks are parked across the street. What's the fire department doing? He goes, what are you doing, right? The shul's burning and you're doing nothing. We're here to protect the homes around the shul, right? If the shul burns down, the other homes can burn down. So they just sat there, and they're not trying to deny this. And it was like the next day that, he's going to, petition the local authorities in Cologne that, the fire department did. These were the authorities. So this is the reality that Jews were living in. And all of a sudden that you have a state that's going to be able to say that, and the Rav even uses this expression, ayin tachat ayin, that not in the Talmudic sense, but in the literal biblical sense, that dam Yehudi eino hefker, was, he felt, a fifth knock, that God was revealing himself in this way as well. And sixth, and finally, reflecting especially on the years that followed Hakamat HaMdina, the Rav noted the fact that the Medinat Yisrael represented a sixth and final opportunity for Kibbutz Goliot. Those who know the history, often overlooked history of Eidot HaMizrach, of the Jewish communities of the Levant and the Mediterranean, know that while there's always some degree of tension between the Muslim majority and the Jewish minority, there were in many places very positive relationships between the Jewish people and the majority communities. However, following the establishment of the State of Israel, things became very uncomfortable. And an enormous amount of tension was created to the point where Jews, really 800,000 or so Jews, leave their homelands, Iraq and Syria, Morocco, Tunisia, Egypt. This happens over a period of time. Yemen, of course, and return to the land of Israel. And the idea that there's a Medina there to be able, and I'm not saying the Medina behaved perfectly in this respect. That's far from the truth. And Jews of Eastern origin were subject to all kinds of terrible discrimination, which is certainly not our subject for now. But the point was is that there would be an opportunity for kibbutz goliot, for Jews who for so long had nowhere to run when the chips were down, that they would have a place to go. So Medinat Yisrael represented at least six opportunities that could not be ignored and deserved the support of the Jewish community. So this is the Rav's most famous, aspect of his argument. Now, what I just wanted to read here, because I think that this is something that really should continue to speak to us today, is the Rav's attitude towards not just American Jewry, but the Rav directs himself towards the American Orthodox community. In a chapter called "The Obligation of Torah Judaism to the Land of Israel," and like I mentioned at the outset, these words are not subtle, I simply want to read them. And the Rav said this again over 60 years ago, but I think it does bear repeating. So this happens to be page 46 in my edition. Let us publicly and frankly confess. We complain about certain Israeli leaders and their attitude toward the values of our tradition and religious practice. Well, you have Orthodox Jews who say these people are secular, these people are anti-religious, so on. The complaints are justified. We have serious charges against the secular leadership of the land of Israel. However, are only they to be blamed? And are we as faultless and pure as the heavenly angels? Such an assumption is without foundation. We could have extended our influence and done something to shape the spiritual character of the land if we had but hurried to awaken from our slumber and open the door for the beloved who is knocking, Kol Dodi Dofek. I fear that we Orthodox Jews are still enveloped in sweet slumber. If we were to establish more religious kibbutzim, if we were to build more housing for religious immigrants, if we were to establish an extensive system of schools, our situation would be completely different. Then there would be no need to come forward with complaints against the leaders of other movements. We Orthodox Jews suffer from a unique illness that is not found in non-religious Jews. We are miserly. We do not excel when it comes to giving generously. In comparison with the rest of the American Jewish community, we are satisfied to part with a couple of pennies, and we demand in recompense for our piddling donations our reward in this world and a share in the first allocations. Thus, our dignity has reached its nadir, and we do not exercise appropriate influence on Jewish life here in America and on the course of events in Israel, etc., etc. So the Rav's basic point here is that instead of complaining about secularism in Medinat Yisrael, we should do something about it. And he goes on to say, with great frankness and candor, that this, again, even though he himself chose not to make this personal decision, that the original sin of the American Orthodox community was in not making Aliyah in much greater numbers. The Rav writes as follows. Had the land been settled by an industrious, successful, and cultured people, had the land been populated and developed, our attachment to it would have been eroded by the course of events, and no Jewish foot would have trod upon it. Strangers would have eaten its boundary and its fruit, and our rights would become null and void. However, the land of Israel did not betray the Jewish people. It was loyal to them, awaiting redemption throughout the years. The Rav here is referring to the rabbinic tradition that no other nation was able to properly develop the land of Israel. Logic dictates, then, that when the Jewish community was given the opportunity to return to its land, which had withheld its treasures from foreigners and stored them for us, Orthodox Jews should have hastened to perform so great a mitzvah, to plunge with joy and enthusiasm into the very midst of this holy work, the building and the settling of the land of Israel. However, to our regret, we have not reacted this way. When the desolate one, this is a reference to the land of Israel, that remained desolate, waiting for the Jewish people to return, which longingly waited for us from era to era, invited us to come and redeem her from her desolation, and when the beloved who watched over the desolation for almost 1900 years and decreed that this time no tree should grow and no well should fructify the land, beckoned at the door of the lover, again the image of Kol Dodi Dofek, God is calling us back and saying the land will bloom and bloom only for you, we, the Orthodox Jews, did not bestir ourselves from our beds to open the door for our beloved. If we had contiguous settlements throughout the land from Eilat to Dan, our situation would be very different. So the Rav is noting is that, you know, it's easy for people to sit back and you know, critique the state of Israel for all kinds of, you know, what he calls justified complaints about the certain attitudes that people may have towards religiosity. But what would be much more important and constructive, to be honest, would be to do something about it. And here you have people that three times a day, every single day for 2,000 years, spoke about divine redemption and being able to return to the land of Israel. And when the opportunity beckons, koldo dido fake, he's knocking at the door, you know, take out an Israeli flag on Yom HaTzmud and then go back to the Yankees. You know, so it's a prop. Or the, in his case, the Red Sox. So the Rav was actually asked that question in the letter. There was actually an Israeli high school teacher who wrote a letter to the Rav saying that she felt that Kol Dodi Dofek was the most beautiful thing that had ever been written from a religious Zionist point of view. How is it possible that this man lives in Boston, Massachusetts, commutes to Washington Heights? How is this possible? She says, this is the most eloquent expression of the idea of religious Zionism I've ever heard. How is it possible? And what's very I can't repeat the exact word that he used in the letter because it's no longer politically correct. He didn't mean it in that context. But the Rav replied to this letter in Hebrew, and he didn't attempt to make excuses for himself. Whatever his personal considerations and calculations were, and I think it's an important question, at least in this context, he basically said, guilty is charged. I have not lived up to the vision that I articulated in that particular essay. So the message here, I think, is really twofold. Number one, at minimum, it's incumbent upon us to appreciate the historical times that we lived in. It was powerful enough for the Rav, as I said, to undergo a profound ideological metamorphosis from the perspective that he grew up with, that he inherited in his father and grandfather's home, to a radically different, a diametrically opposite perspective on the significance of Medinat Yisrael. At minimum, it means that, for us to try and have a deeper sense of appreciation. But more broadly, as we concluded with, what the Rav was really saying is that, you know, there's a lot of tautology in the religious community in the United States of America where it says, Israel has this problem, Israel has that problem, Israel has that problem. But if people would go and do something about it, so then maybe the situation would be completely different. You know, one of the main challenges, again, this is not my chiddush, you just, you know, have to know a little bit of arithmetic and current events. One of the main challenges that Israel has is the idea of declaring sovereignty over the entire biblical land of Israel, including the biblical heartland of Israel, including Yehuda and Shomron. I'll just be somewhat oblique here, brings along certain demographic challenges, right? If we're going to, you know, unless you're going to be willing to deny large sections of the population, some massive number of people, the right to vote, then you're going to have a very serious problem as to what to do. Now, if millions and millions more Jews lived in Israel, right, so that would be much, much less of an issue. So it's not as if, like, these are theoretical questions. They bear very directly on our ability to have full sovereignty over Medinat Yisrael. I'm not saying that's a simple question or that's the only consideration. But again, instead of, you know, tautologically saying, oh, Israel has all these problems and therefore we should keep our distance from it, the Rav's attitude was, if you see problems, then the constructive thing to do is to go and do something about it to address those issues. So especially 25 years after the Rav's passing, and as we think about Yom HaShoah, going on from that to Yom HaTzmaut, it's certainly an appropriate time to revisit Kol Dodi Dofek, to hear the Rav's voice in his own words calling to us and telling us, especially in the position that we are in, with the opportunity to influence young people, the opportunity to share certain ideas and ideals with them, to encourage them not to make the mistake of the lover in Shir Hashirim, but Kol Dodi Dofeik, to hear the knock of our beloved at the door, the many knocks in truth, and to answer in an appropriate fashion. So Joanne, may your father's neshama have an aliyah on this, his eighth yahrzeit, and we all, over the next few weeks, really take these messages as much to heart as we possibly can for ourselves, for our own families, and especially in this particular context, for our students as well.
Thank you.